welcome to Inspired Island, where every episode we sit down with someone living an inspired life here on Vashon Island in Puget Sound. From world-class artists and musicians to chefs and business owners, our little rural island has it all. I'm your host, Grace McCray, a new full-time Vashon Island resident, and thank you for joining me on this journey to discover why Vashon is such an inspired island. Hello, everyone. Today is part two in a special two-part series we are doing here on Inspired Island, which has been really fun. We are getting to know the duo behind the upcoming show, Gay Beret, which will be at Vashon Center for the Arts on November 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Gay Beret was written and will be performed by husbands David Milkey and Thomas Hitoshi Pruksma. Last week, we got to know David, and if you missed that episode, you can find it at voiceofvashon.org and search for Inspired Island. And today, we will be getting to know Tom. So Tom is a writer, a poet, a translator, a teacher, and a performer. He has published multiple books, including a book this year of poems called The Safety of Edges. Tom also performs his original work, weaving together story, poetry, magic, and song. So, Tom, I'm really excited to get to know you, having just met David.
Thank you, Grace. Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'd love to know a little bit about your backstory.
I was born and raised in Seattle.
Okay.
Which I enjoy being able to tell people. For instance, if I'm in Seattle and I meet someone and they say, oh, where are you from? I say, well, I'm from Seattle. And they look at me with this sort of strange, amazed look, like, oh, you're actually from here? Wow, I didn't know there are any more people around.
A unicorn.
Here. But after going to college, I ended up living in South India for a total of 5 years, where I was originally I went because I was interested in understanding something about rooted rural communities, a village community. I wanted to live in a village. And I got a fellowship which had me teaching at a college, teaching English and learning the Tamil language. All of which I saw as sort of preparing me for this exploration of community life. And then I did end up living in a village. And as sort of an interesting byproduct of that time, I also, through learning the Tamil language, reconnected with my love of words and of not just words that are spoken, but words that are sung, the music of language more generally. And so when I came back I was there for 2.5 years and then I came back. When I came back from that time in India, I was newly awake and newly alive to language, and took a kind of existential decision, if you will. I suddenly realized, oh yeah, of course, what I wanted to do all along is to be a writer, to write and to have time to write, to have time to read. And so from that point onwards, I arranged my life, arranged my affairs in such a way that I always had time to write and read, sometimes living in unusual circumstances. That's, in fact, how I first ended up on Vashon. I wanted to live in a place where I could work on a farm part of the time and spend the rest of the time writing. And I had a friend, I still have a friend named Amy Bogard, who has a farm, who had a farm, Hogsback Farm. And she said, oh, well, you could come and you can stay on the farm and you can work half time on the farm. And there's one of these old picker's cottages in the back field that you can stay in for the summer. It was warm enough that I wouldn't need to worry about heating the little cottage. And so that's how I ended up on the island.
Wow.
And so every day I'd get up and I'd do my reading and writing. And then in the afternoons I'd be out working on the farm and taking care of the chickens and weeding and all the other things that needed to be done.
And did you have these inclinations towards reading and writing and also being outside working on farms? Did any of that surface before your time in India, or was that really when it surfaced?
As a kid, I had a fascination with words. I would sometimes try to make up my own words for things. And of course, nobody else understood them. And when I was really young, I was confused because I thought, well, there's other words that people use that I don't understand, but then I learn them. Why don't people learn the words I've made up? And basically, through all of my school years, all the way through high school, I thought of myself as more and more as being a writer.
Mm.
I took great pleasure in writing and writing all kinds of things, not just, you know, things for school, but stories and poems, and also plays. I became quite interested in playwriting, and taught myself reading books and reading plays, how to write plays. And a lot of that shifted when I went off to college, because at the same time, I was quite concerned about the sort of ecological turmoil we're living in. And I thought, well, I need to, you know, go off to college and learn how to do something to save the planet and do something, you know, that can be helpful to the world situation. And so in my mind, that meant writing wasn't all that important because it just wastes paper and should really become a politician or a biologist or something like that. And so I pushed myself in a lot of different ways, none of which felt quite right. I did, in the midst of all of this, discover philosophy, which is what I ended up majoring in, which may seem quite impractical, but I was interested in the study of ethics and the question of how to live. That was sort of my real topic. And so in this sort of journey of trying to figure out how I would answer that question, I went through a period of jettisoning whole parts of myself. I threw music out the window. And thought, well, if I just have to study ethics and biology and politics or whatever the combination might be to figure all this stuff out. And that's sort of what led me to this interest in rural communities and in rooted communities that led me to India, which paradoxically brought me back again to words. And there was a very specific experience that reawakened that, re-inspired me, if you will, which is that Tamil, the language of Tamil Nadu that I learned, is what linguists call a diglossic language. It has very distinct written and spoken forms. So you can learn how to read and write, but not be able to have a conversation with someone in the streets and vice versa. And I thought, because I wanted to live in a rural community, if I can learn how to speak and understand what people are saying to me, that's more than enough for me, because that seemed impossible at the time. But I had a wonderful teacher, a man named Dr. K.V. Ramakodi. He was actually the teacher of my first Tamil teacher, who was an American and who taught at a sort of intensive course at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he had put me in touch with his teacher, and I started studying with him basically the week after I arrived in India. And one of the things that was so remarkable about him as a teacher is that he knew how to cultivate and to stimulate your own enthusiasm, your own interest. And so he would take me and another person, we were studying there together, more and more deeply into the language, and pushing us to be content, not to be content with just pleasantries, but to learn the sort of vocabulary and to gain the linguistic skills necessary to have a conversation about real things, about philosophy or literature or life or whatever. And at one point during my study with him, he said, okay, well, I think we should learn to read and write. And I said, sir, well, that's a wonderful idea, but I'm not sure I have the time and I'm not sure I'm up to it, really. And he said, well, when you go back to your country, you do want to be able to write us letters, don't you? And I said, well, yes, sir, of course I would like to do that. And he said, you would like to be able to read the replies we will send you? No. And I said, yes, of course. He said, well, we'll begin tomorrow. And we actually went through the entire series of government readers, starting with what was called UKG and LKG, basically kindergarten, all the way up through the equivalent of 12th grade, plus one and plus two in their system, starting with very basic reading and writing all the way up to, you know, reading essays and short stories and things like that. But my teacher never had me read the poetry in these readers, because he didn't like the poems that they had chosen and didn't like the way they had laid it out. And then one day he announced to me that we were going to start learning poetry. Now, something that may be surprising to people who know me now is that poetry was something that for years I didn't really get. I think I had it sort of schooled out of me in high school, where we were busy analyzing poems and sort of taking them apart and dissecting them, almost like you might dissect a frog and figure out the meaning of the poem hidden here behind the liver or the spleen or you know, the lungs. And I think part of it was that I was, as a teenager and as a college student, I was quite obsessed with the question of what things meant with meaning. We studied philosophy, and I didn't have the patience for what seemed to me mere ornamentation about metaphors and flowers or, you know, pretty pictures with words. I was interested in what does it mean and how are we supposed to live and what's right and wrong and these sorts of questions. And as a result, I was unable to be open to poetry. I was kind of closed to it in a way. And then my teacher said, well, we're going to study poetry. And because I'd gone this far with him, I said, okay, I guess we'll study poetry.
Why not?
Why not? And he had me start with a 12th century Tamil woman, poet and saint named Avayar. And he had me memorize her poems. Now, because these were, you know, 800, 900 year old poems, I couldn't really understand them directly yet. They're not very complicated poems, but there was enough sort of time. I needed to learn more vocabulary and some more grammatical things to really get them. So all I could do when I memorized them was really memorize the pattern of sounds. I would write them out on a little piece of paper that I'd have in my pocket, and on the bus to and from his house, I would look at my cheat sheet and I'd recite these things to myself over and over again. And what that forced me to do was not worry about the meaning, not be obsessed with the question of meaning, and instead begin to listen to the sounds that the words make, the rhythms, the music of the words. There's still a phrase I remember. It goes like this in the Tamil. It goes, Nir mel yaratir kener. And I found myself saying that to me, because saying that to myself, because it had a kind of music to it. Nir mel yaratir kener. The way it begins with this nir sound and then ends with this ner sound, which is not quite the same, but they both have these long vowels and they start with an N sound and end with an R sound, but you have this nir ner, and that's kind of neat. These poems, I realize, sound good. There is a pleasure to the, just to the sounds alone, to the sonic qualities of the poem. Nir mel yernatir kener. It had a kind of rhythm to it. And so then when I did get to the question of what the poems meant, that meaning was all the more meaningful because I could hear the meaning interwoven with this music. And that proved to be, for me, the great opening, the great door back not only into English and to hearing English in a new way, but also to being open to poetry and to discover that poetry offers a way to say things because it involves music and because it involves rhythm and silence and brevity. It can say things that probably couldn't otherwise be said and can't, in fact, be said the same way in prose, because they take us beyond the kind of prosaic or more mundane or the more things that we can sort of lay out literally to that edge of language. That's probably why, at least part of why, the name of this book of poems that I published this year came to me as it did, The Safety of Edges, which has to do with the paradoxical safety of being at the edge of what can be said, or being at the edge of our experience, or being at the edge between one part of our life entering into another part of our life. So from that experience in Tamil, in a way, going all the way to the other side of the world, and learning a completely different language than English, returned me to English in a much more profound and astonishing and at the same time grateful way than I had it before. And so this childhood impulse to make words and to play with language and my interest as an adolescent in writing and then in sort of this obsession with meaning all got to circle around again into poetry as a kind of interweaving or integrating of all of these things, the question of meaning, the question of music, the possibility of music in our words, and the possibility of saying things beyond the edge of what we can normally say.
Yeah. And how long did it take you from when you finally refound poetry to create your own poems?
I often say that I've had a very long apprenticeship.
Okay.
So it's about 20 years of memorizing poems in several languages, which was sort of the first practice. My first interest was not so much in writing poetry, but in just reading it and memorizing it and reciting it out loud. And then I found that there were poems in Tamil that I wanted to be able to share with people in English. And I didn't want to share them as just a kind of, this is what the poem means or a summary. I wanted to share them as poems. And so I started to try to translate these poems as poems. And that's where my apprenticeship to writing poetry began. I got to apprentice myself to some extraordinary poets in Tamil and then later on in Spanish. And through that, began to have a facility to write poetry in English, which would then sort of reinforce the ability to translate poetry. And then that went on to various other kinds of studies and practices. I've gone years where I've written a poem every day for a whole year, not even necessarily keeping any of them, but just to as a musician might play scales at the piano to build up the creative capacity, the facility with language. So it's really only now, after many years of effort and also some years of not effort, by which I mean, I think in any writer's or artist's journey, there's a period or there's a time when all of that consciously acquired technique, the art sort of demands you to let go of that. I mean, you still employ it, you still use it, but you're trying to find a way to make something happen beyond what you could plan, beyond what you might map out in advance. So writing becomes, just in the case of writing becomes more an act of listening than of writing, not thinking up something to say and saying it, but opening oneself to hear what wants to be said and then following where that goes, which may go someplace very different than I might have expected when I started writing a sentence or following through with an idea or something like that. And in a way, this the show that we're doing is also part of this larger journey of bringing pieces together, bringing threads of not only life experience, but also artistic interests and artistic pursuits together. For instance, in the show, I have written the arrangements on piano for most of the songs, and some of the songs I've composed entirely. That was something I used to like to do as a kid. I like to make up songs at the piano in our house when nobody else was listening. And I just sort of, you know, doodle around and make up my own things. And I try to notate them. And there was a sort of seed of the possibility of making my own music, not just playing something that somebody else had written. And so I explored that for a while. And then it sort of went to the side as I went on to other things. And there were two experiences or two impulses that I had in the past 10, 15 years to study forms of piano that I wasn't. I was trained as a classical pianist, but I wanted to learn gospel piano. And I found a gospel pianist, and he's a wonderful, really basically gospel director, choir leader. And I studied with him for a time and learned about that. And I had no idea where this was going to go. And it's not like I wanted to go and, you know, become a gospel pianist, but I wanted to know something about that style, because I heard something in that, or if it made me feel something that other forms of music didn't make me feel as readily. And then I also wanted to learn how to improvise. And so I studied with a wonderful jazz pianist in Seattle for a couple years, and which is sort of strange because I enjoy jazz, but I'm not a jazz lover. But I was interested in this: how does one learn to improvise? And so I learned a lot of things from him, really about music theory and chord structure and all of these things which make jazz improvisation possible. And then that sort of ran its course, and I thought, you know, what am I doing with all of this stuff? Why have I been drawn to these things? And it's only in the last couple of years when I realized, oh, well, now I know enough to follow on or to sort of continue nourishing that seed from childhood of creating my own songs or arranging, making arrangements of songs, because now I have sort of music theory in practice from jazz and from gospel piano. And so I've been really having a blast creating these songs or arranging these songs for the show, along with the writing and performing of the show as a whole.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you've spent so much time really studying and mastering both words and like poetry and music, and now it's to the point where you can kind of play. Is that
it is a lot like playing and getting to draw on all of these different parts of our experience. And in some ways, you know, just as this is occurring to me in this moment, is that one of the great gifts of being with David and of having that kind of relationship is that we from the very beginning have had as it's kind of our touchstone that our relationship is about helping each other be all of who we are, helping each other grow into being more fully ourselves. And what that's meant for me has been to sort of look at all of these seemingly separate pieces of my life and realize, oh, well, maybe I can draw these together. Maybe there's a way of bringing them together into a kind of harmony, to use one metaphor, or to a kind of poetry, to use a different but related metaphor. And so in some ways, that's what in doing this show is allowing all of these strands, a sort of philosophical strand, poetic strand, musical strand, compositional strand, to come together in a new and, for me, very exciting way. See what can happen with these ingredients all set into motion.
Absolutely. And do you have a favorite phrase or song or any example of your ability to create using words in the Gay Beret?
I'm not sure if this exactly answers your question, but the first thing that occurs to me is there is a song in the show which is actually based on a poem. And the poem is called The Courage to Wait. And it's actually a poem I wrote in the voice of my friend. A little backstory is when I was, I lived for a couple of years in Columbus, Ohio, and I had three wonderful housemates, and they got to see me go through a kind of reawakening. For years, I'd been so intent on writing and translating and poetry that I didn't have much of a social life. And I didn't even, you know, I was single and I didn't have any great impulse to go out and look. I always told people that if, you know, it's not like, you know, if I met somebody I really liked, then I would let something happen. But I think that was a story I told myself. I was kind of in a kind of celibate apprenticeship period. Mm-hmm. And then a series of things happened where I was, and it was part of my return to the Pacific Northwest, in fact, where this new yearning was reawakened in me to find somebody and to settle down with someone, not just to date someone, but to have a life partner. So I was filled with this great longing, and I got quite smitten with some people, and nothing happened, and it was very tumultuous kind of life period for me. And so this friend sort of, you know, she said, you know, of course you would be, you know, sighing for your beloved. Of course you would resonate with these, you know, old poems about love sickness or these sorts of things. Anyway, so she had given me some advice once, and then I sort of wrote that into a poem in her voice to say to myself, so to speak. And then this poem has entered the show with me adding music to it.
Oh, cool.
About, well, the title, The Courage to Wait, which refers not only to the courage to wait for, to not sort of rush out and try to find somebody to fit. You're going to be my life partner, even if you don't get poetry, or you're, you know, trying to make something happen, as opposed to being open to allowing something to happen, which in my creative life is more and more the posture or the stance that I take. And I was learning to discover that in my sort of my wider life, my personal life, the courage to wait for something to unfold on its own, if you will.
Mm.
And so the song is an exploration of that possibility, and interestingly ties all of these other pieces together. So that's a little backstory about a phrase in the show.
We'll keep our ears open for that during Gay Beret. So you have mentioned that you learned Spanish. I read online that you spent some time in Mexico. Is that right?
I lived in Oaxaca, Mexico for 3 summers because there is a man there named Gustavo Esteva, a wonderful writer and activist and intellectual of sorts, thinker, who was very important and still is very important to me, and speaks wonderful English. But I wanted to be able to enter into his world more fully. Mm. And so I got myself to Mexico and I learned Spanish using a very unusual technique from a man named Iván Illich, who was one of Gustavo's, one of the important people in Gustavo's circle. Which had me memorizing again. This is to sort of reiterate a theme. It had me remember this method had me memorize 4 pages of prose and 6 pages of poetry in Spanish before I understood what they meant.
Huh.
And I worked with somebody so that I got the pronunciation and the rhythm of the sentences more or less accurate. And then I just worked on those until I could say them out as if I were talking, as we're talking right here. And then worked backwards from there, so to speak, or backwards according to the usual way, you know, you learn grammar and the words and then you make sentences. Well, this is, now I could make sentences not knowing grammar or words. A process which, as I see now, mimics the way we actually learn language as kids. We don't We don't learn grammar. We don't learn words. We learn patterns of sounds. We can even say patterns of sounds not knowing what they mean because we hear people around us saying them. I remember my parents saying, oh, we'll take I-5 to go somewhere. I had no idea what I-5 was. I didn't know that it stood for Interstate 5. I didn't even know they were talking about the freeway. I just knew there was this thing called I-5 that they talked about. So I could say, oh, we're going to take I-5 and not know what they meant. Anyway, so this mimics that. And so it sort of imprints on the mind the structure of the language at a deeper level because it's not being thought about in English, if that makes sense. Anyway, so I use this method, and it allowed me to learn Spanish quite a bit more quickly than I learned Tamil. I mean, Spanish is also closer to English, and I also had the practice of having learned another language deeply. So I learned Spanish, and then I began translating a wonderful novel by the Mexican writer Juan Rulfo. He has an extraordinary novel called Pedro Páramo. It's a very short, 130-page book, and is consistently one of the best books in Spanish of the 20th century. Extraordinarily poetically charged masterpiece, which is not very well known in English. So that's been one of my ongoing projects, is to not only to translate the novel, which I have done and I've worked on for a number of years, but also to get it published, because there's some legal hurdles in the way of there being another translation in the world. So I went back to Oaxaca for 2 summers to work on the translation and to be in Mexico and be able to ask, you know, people questions about intricate phrases or colloquial phrases and so on. And also to keep up my friendships in that place also.
Beautiful. And do you have any, besides the reflections on words and language, what have you learned from living in different cultures?
From both my experience in South India and my experience in Southern Mexico. And Southern Mexico, I should add, is a very special place because it still has quite a bit of the indigenous element, or elements of the culture are quite strong. I mean, they are all over Mexico, but you have more indigenous languages being spoken in the state of Oaxaca, and you can feel it in the air, in a sense, and in very, you know, everyday practices and the ways that people interact with one another. But from South India and from Southern Mexico, I gained deep appreciation of the art and practice of hospitality. And not just at the level of welcoming someone into your home and offering them more food than they can possibly eat, though that is part of it, but also at a deeper and, if you will, existential level, the openness to another person, that deep openness to someone that you maybe don't or maybe even can't understand. That to me has been very important. How we open ourselves to people whose worldview might be radically different from our own. How people who might also welcome us, even though our worldview may seem radically different. That has been very important to me, and also allowed me, I think, to be much more, or I should say much less rigid about my ideas or about my sense of time or my, it has helped make me aware of assumptions that I was assuming without assuming that I was assuming them. It has made me much more flexible, I think, as existentially flexible. There's a phrase in my way of relating with people and with the world.
Awesome. And do you find time to travel these days?
Yes. I think David last week was telling about our cat Callie, which we cared for until she died, as caring for her and the sort of Marie's legacy there. And after she died, I was able to take David to Oaxaca and introduce him to my life in Mexico. And I also took him to India, and I got to introduce him to my Tamil teacher, who was still living there.
Wow.
And also the village that I was basically adopted into, and other important friends and teachers there. And I have a relationship with those places and with the people in those places such that it's hard to stay away for too long. In fact, the village that I lived in South India, the family that I'm basically now a part of, they've just built a new house, and they want to, for the annual festival, they want to host a drama. Now, this is a festival where they have 4 or 5, sometimes 10 nights of plays. These plays start at 10 p.m. ish, and they go through till dawn. And the first play, everybody in the village they pool their money and they bring in a troupe of actors to perform their favorite play. It's the same play every year. Everybody loves to see it again. And then all of the plays after that are put on by different families or different groups in the village to celebrate some accomplishment, or as a kind of thank you to the goddess of the village for whom which is at the center of these festivals. You know, they've asked the goddess for help with something and they've received what they asked for. And so in gratitude, they sponsor this play for the village. Anyway, so the family, my village family wants to put on a play and wants me to be there for that. So I got to find some way to get there and get back there for that.
That'd be cool. Yeah. Maybe you can tape the gay beret and share it with them.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned how you really were hoping to structure your life in a way that you could read, write. These days, does your life look anything like that, like when you first came to Vashon?
My life looks crazier than ever, but in delightful and delicious, wonderful ways. I may not have quite the expansiveness of my writing time that I had when I first started out, but I have very sort of concentrated time every day to work on the writing. Right now, of course, we're quite involved with the show, not only rehearsing it, but also doing some rewrites and you know, getting the word out about it and so on. You know, perhaps as part of talking about this flexibility, that that's something I've grown in, even, you know, recently and being with David also, how to hold on to that sense of, I want to write every day, I want to have time to do all these things, but how to find a rhythm that is more dynamic. That is, you know, it used to be quite rigid, every day up at 5, writing at 5:30, 5:30 to 10:30 or something like that. And that was great for that period of time, for that part of the apprenticeship. Now I have a much more, like I say, fluid and dynamic schedule where maybe it's not the same time every day, but the time gets in there.
Mm.
Because there's rehearsals to go to, or because there's other sort of the projects that have come my way that I want to attend to. So the days are full, but flexible.
And if there's anybody listening who this interview's stoking or reigniting an interest in, like, oh, I used to like poetry, but it's not really part of my life anymore. Do you have any favorite English language poets?
One of my favorite poets is a man named Hayden Carruth, who I got to befriend in the years before his death. And I think he's not only a wonderful poet, but he's also quite accessible.
Mm.
He wrote a lot of his poems from rural Vermont, where he lived for quite a time. And he had a way of fusing a very down-home, almost folksy sensibility with a powerful intellect and philosophical perceptiveness. So he's one of the people that comes to mind. Another is the farmer and poet Wendell Berry, who's been a very important person to me for a long time and whose poems also have a combination of openness and accessibility as well as profundity, which is what I think the great poets have, the poets that mean the most to me, have always managed to achieve in their work. Even a very simple folk song-like poem can contain surprising and sometimes astonishing wisdom about human relationships and about a relationship with nature or with the world.
Mm.
One more person that comes to mind who's a poet that I have taken a little longer to enter into her work is Denise Levertov. She actually ended up spending the last years of her life in Seattle. She is somebody. So a little backstory. There's a wonderful bookstop shop in Seattle called Open Books and a poem emporium. And I went there with a friend of mine from high school when we were both in high school, and he was a poet. And I liked his poems, but I didn't really get them. And I said, before I go to college, I want to help me choose a book of poems. I'm going to take it to college. I'm going to read this book of poems. And so we chose a book of Denise Levertov's poems. I think it was Selected Poems 1968 to 1972 or something like that. It was a compilation of three books from that period in her life. And I took it off to college and I tried to read this book. I kind of got it, but it didn't really light up for me. And so it sat on my shelf for years. And then after this sort of reawakening to language, I've come back more and more intently to her work as well, just astonished by some of these these poems. In that very book that I had on my shelf, there's a poem called Relearning the Alphabet, which blows me away every time I read it. Really beautiful. And she's a, in some ways, her poems feel less like poetry. The voice is sort of more closer to a speaking voice. And yet there's this interesting, fiery, spiritual energy that seems to pulse through even the most innocent seeming poem.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. So, Tom, other than Gaborey, which is happening November 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, what's on the horizon for you? Any fun, other fun projects in the works or anything that's really inspiring you these days?
It's a couple of different things. I mean, one is directly connected with Gaborey. We've also put together a panel on the 21st called A Prelude to a Gaborey, a historical panel on the art of transformation. And that's been exciting for us to curate. We're bringing together these five very interesting panelists from different walks of life, different backgrounds. And so I'm looking forward to helping sort of moderate and curate our conversation. Beyond that, I have a book that I'm working on. When I met my agent, a wonderful woman named Mala Gabaldi, she was interested in a novel of mine and has been working to sell this novel. And she mentioned offhand that her wife, Lucy, had taken a yurt building workshop. I don't know how this came up. Somehow it came up. And I said, oh, well, I live in a yurt. And she said, oh, well, we're going to have to talk. Because she explained to me that she'd been wanting to pitch a book to publishers about living in a yurt. Because there are lots of books about building yurts. You build your own yurt, or a history of yurts, or picture books with yurts in them. But she said there's not very much about the actual experience, day-to-day life experience of living in one. And so I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. And I sort of put it on my shelf of ideas, assuming that, you know, we'll sell the novel and then we'll go from there. And it's been taking longer to sell the novel than I anticipated. About 5 or 6 months ago, I happened to wake up fairly early in the morning. I was just lying in bed and I suddenly thought, well, if I were to write a book about living in a yurt, maybe I would start here and maybe I would include this and maybe I'd include that. And I realized I was starting to write the first chapter of this book. So I got up and I started writing my notes down and sent a note off to Malaga and said, you still want a yurt book? And she said, yes. And so I've been working on this yurt book. I'm about halfway through the draft and I'm excited about how that's going. I'm also preparing to shoot another series of episodes for Cozy Grammar, the series that David and I now get to be part of the series that David originally did with Marie. So I'm looking forward to writing the episodes for the that would correspond with the episodes in the basic Cozy Intermediate grammar course. And then I also have an event in January that I'm particularly excited about at Town Hall in Seattle on the 30th of January. I think it's a Thursday, Thursday night, 7:30, something like that, where I'm going to be in conversation. I'm going to give a talk. And there's going to be a Kora player who will perform in between the first half of the program and the second half of the program. And in the second half, I'll be in conversation with someone. And the whole evening is going to be around poetry and wonder. So I'll get to share some thoughts, share some poems, and be in conversation about those topics, both of which are quite dear to my heart.
Cool. Well, would you be up, Tom, for partaking in our fun little lightning round of questions?
I most definitely would, and I haven't thought about them, so I want to see what really actually just jumps into my mind.
Good. The first question is, so the Seattle area, as you know, being a Seattle native, is very well known for good beverages from coffee, tea, beer, wine. Do you have a favorite beverage here on Vashon Island?
I have several.
Ooh.
I love the Thai iced tea at May Kitchen.
Mm.
I love the mochas at Mingle Mint because they're dark, and I like them that way. And I also love the Nepali chia at Anurana's, which is basically what we call chai from India, but it's actually from Nepal, and it has its own particular spices and taste to it. And I'm quite fond of those three drinks.
And next is, where can people most often find you if you're not at work or home? Like, do you have any favorite little spots on Vashon?
You can often find me at the library.
Okay.
For years, I would tutor students and I would meet with them at the library. Now I go there to pick up books use the computers for things. And to get one of the things I love about the library and the library system is that you can get books through interlibrary loan. So I get books about Tummel, I get books about magic and, you know, crazy things delivered to me at the library, and I run there to pick them up.
Excellent. And do you have any pet peeves about island living? Any downsides to living on an island?
Well, not really a lot. The only thing that comes to mind is we live down 171st, and when we come up, and if I want to take a left to go into town, and the ferry has just come off, it feels like forever to make that left turn, except sometimes there's a nice person who says, oh, this is a long ferry line. This person probably just needs to go into town. I'm going to slow down and let them make the left turn, and I love that.
Bless those people.
Yes, indeed.
And do you have any favorite Vashon Island traditions?
I love that the whole center of town gets shut down for Halloween.
Mm.
Well, I mean, not just for Halloween. For Halloween, for Starry Festival, for these other, for that electric bike festival thing, or electric lights, stupid bike festival, I think it was called something. Yeah. I love shutting down the main street and turning it into a place where people can walk and gawk at each other's costumes or whatever it is. I love that spirit because it reminds me of places I lived in South India or in Mexico where there is a kind of plaza or a village center, which is not dominated by cars, but which is people on foot meeting and talking and interacting. So I love that we get to have a bit of that here on Vashon too for those festivals and festivities.
Yeah, beautiful. And lastly, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
You can learn more about me and my work at my website, thomasproxma.com. And there is also information about my contributions to Cozy Grammar at cozygrammar.com, and also about Gay Beret and our show and the collaboration with David at driftwoodbridge.com.
Okay.
So those are a couple of different places.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much, Tom. This has been really delightful.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be here.
And thank you all for listening. Again, this is Inspired Island on KVSH LP Vashon 101.9 FM. Until next time, stay inspired.